recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. We've got Ralph Losey with us again on ESI Bytes, and today we're going to talk about specialization in electronic discovery. Do you need to have a specialist to do electronic discovery work? How far can a generalist go? Should everyone know about electronic discovery? These and other topics are areas we're going to cover. Ralph's getting to the point where he almost doesn't need an introduction like Craig Ball, but anyone who tracks either electronic discovery or ESI Bytes knows who Ralph is. He is one of the most widely read blogs in the industry. He's published a number of books. In fact, he's coming out with a third book. I think it's coming out around when Legal Tech happens in February, as well as three law review articles in the last 3 years, making him one of the more prolific writers in the field, if not the most prolific writer. These are books published through the American Bar Association on e-discovery. He's also a partner at the Florida-based AmLaw 100 law firm. Is it Ackerman? I know I mess this up all the time. Ackerman?
Yeah, you got it right.
Ackerman. Ackerman
yes,
Centerfit.
Old man Ackerman blesses you.
My name's Carl Shinneman, and no one ever gets that right, so it's I understand name issues. But he chairs their electronic discovery practice, and at a recent Georgetown University Advanced E-Discovery Conference back in November, Ralph and Jason Barron brought down the house with a short film clip pointing out how scary the volumes are growing and how we need to change how we approach ESI dealing with an escalating problem or it's going to be a train wreck. It was sort of like 2001 Odyssey experienced by Stanley Kubrick without the hallucinogenic drugs. It was very well produced and very thought-provoking. So first of all, before we talk about your film clip, tell me a little bit about your new book, Electronic Discovery. What's the sort of theme in that?
Well, it is, I guess you could say more of the same, but I think it's even newer and better. I hope my ability to write is somewhat improving with experience. This will be my third book now, and I'm very excited because this one is with a new publisher, with Wes Thomson Reuters, and I'm looking at the draft cover now. It'll be very snazzy. It's going to be called Electronic Discovery: New Ideas, Case Law, Trends, and Practices. If you are a reader of my blog, most of this is going to look very familiar because, like the first two books, this is a book, which means it is a paper book derived from the electronic blogs. And that's sort of my thing, to do that and work with an editor and get it in a paper form, where it's organized by subject and placed together. So if you have read the blog and like it, this will give you a chance to peruse it with the ease of paper and by subject, and also something you can recommend to those of your colleagues and friends that are paper-only people, because there's a lot of information here on how to transcend that kind of limitation and get into the purely digital world.
Boy, we've done about 60 podcasts this year, and I can't even imagine turning this into a book. But I commend you for your efforts. It's an excellent blog. I enjoy reading the blog online. And Ralph, how's your film clip faring? Any notice from it at Cannes or the Sundance Film Festival this year?
I feel like I'm on the Tonight Show or something, plugging my book and movie. But we call it a movie. That's a joke. It's a 6-minute video clip. It comes from the well-known series on YouTube called Did You Know? And this was pioneered by educators who came up with this format, this fast-moving format of throwing about mind-boggling facts at people. Did you know this? Did you know that? But what Jason Barron and I did was prepare an e-discovery version of this film genre, if you will, and of course I'm joking, but of this type of YouTube video, the Did You Know, where we throw a lot of facts about electronic records and what's going on in electronic discovery and in the courts and things like that. Those of you who spend a lot of time in electronic discovery, I'm sure will be familiar with a lot of the facts, if not most of them. But I think that Jason and I have dug up a few new ones you may not have heard before. And in any event, the people that have seen it so far seem to be entertained and amused by the experience.
Is it going to be online? You're going to YouTube it, or?
Yes, it is. That is our eventual plan. I will tell you, Jason found some terrific trance music with it. He did the audio, finding the music, and of course I did my keynote movie magic, if you will, by making all the visual images, and Jason and I worked together to come up with facts, as both of us are kind of love to research, which means we really have no life to speak of outside of e-discovery. But aside from that, we do come up with some interesting information, and we put it together in a movie package, which after we premiere it at LegalTech, we're going to add a nice little disclaimer, and we're going to throw it up on YouTube for the world to see, and hopefully, you know, it'll be helpful to people if they want to start off a CLE on e-discovery or anything to kind of play this to get everybody into the mood of sitting down and, you know, puts them into a trance and overwhelms them with facts, so maybe they'll be more inclined to listen. And, you know, it addresses the fundamental question of why is e-discovery a problem? And at least one of the reasons is there's so much information and it's so complicated. And this video kind of lays that out for you.
You know what? Maybe let's go and jump into specialization, but maybe after LegalTech we'll do a quick show on that so that we can link to it and help you get the word out on that, because I think it's a neat clip. But let's talk about specialization in electronic discovery. And we talked about this last summer, Ralph, when I pointed out I was doing some podcasts with employment lawyers, bankruptcy lawyers, family lawyers, antitrust lawyers, IP lawyers, and some others, specifically on subject matter shows aimed at general practitioners who work in this field and how e-discovery impacts them. And we talked about the issues this raises about whether generalists tackling e-discovery is a good idea, a bad idea, or it depends. And although all lawyers know to take the it depends answer when offered is usually the way to go, would you like to give your opinion on the area?
Well, you know I would. never shy on giving an opinion. And by the way, let me just state for the record something. These are always just my personal opinions. Old man Ackerman, although he passed away, he has nothing to do with this. This is just me and my personal views, not the views of my firm, not the views of any clients, just my personal unrehearsed views, and it is certainly not legal advice. And you would be extremely foolish to rely upon it as legal advice. So that's my disclaimer. I just want to remind everybody about, because I am a practicing attorney, and this is what I do for a living. And what I do is complicated. I didn't realize how complicated e-discovery was until about, because I've been doing e-discovery, you know, since before there was a term e-discovery. I mean, when we had computers. Short background, I was the first lawyer in Orlando, anyway, to have a computer on his desk as a young guy as soon as the PC came out. And even before that, I had one at home. So I was, you know, always used to having computers. And, you know, back in the late 80s, sometimes we started seeing computer files from the clients. And I'd look at it. I'd take Norton, it was called, and look at the stuff right on the hard drive. And, you know, I didn't know that was called computer forensics, but it's just what people did that looked at computer stuff. So I had a lot of experience and, you know, ran my small firm back then. IT, we called it, you know, just ran the computers for the 10, 15 person firm we had for years and years. So, you know, I saw it all from a hands-on user perspective and thought I knew and you know, did know about computers. Thought I knew about e-discovery from not only that kind of general experience over the years, but I was lucky in that in the late 90s, my firm got to handle the defense of one of the largest key TAM cases. That's one of those government fraud cases in Florida, and certainly the biggest one is Central Florida, and it just had a huge electronic discovery component to it with over 300 different offices interconnecting and, you know, a huge IT department. So I spent, you know, 1,000 hours or more just on electronic discovery in that one case in the late 90s. So, you know, based on that, and I thought I knew electronic discovery, right? That would seem reasonable. But I would do electronic discovery, and then I would do just regular commercial litigation, and then I'd move on, and I'd do another subject that judges and generalists hate, and that is ERISA litigation. And, you know, I'd do all kinds of other things. E-discovery was just one of many doors in my life, one of many hats that I would wear. And I think I would call myself not really a generalist in litigation, but, you know, I've done pretty much everything in the civil litigation, commercial litigation area. You name it, I have done it. I don't really do transactional work, though, so in that sense, I'm not a general lawyer. So anyway, when the new rules looked like they were coming out in 2006, I decided, and for a lot of other reasons, personal and public, that I was just going to focus and limit my practice to this new area of electronic discovery and drop all the other stuff. I had some really good trained lawyers that I'd worked with over the years. I turned over my other practice to and my law firm. I thought this was a great idea to do this. And bottom line, for the last 3.5 years, I have only done e-discovery. And the moral of the story is I have learned in the last 3.5 years how little I really knew about e-discovery when I was a generalist, and a pretty damn well-qualified generalist at that. If I do say so myself, I had unusual qualifications. I spent, you know, put in a couple thousand hours on it, but still, as it turns out, in my last 3.5 years of just doing e-discovery, I've learned that a lot of what I thought was the right way to handle things was not. It was wrong. And I have learned that there is so much more depth, and that e-discovery itself is not a little, it is a specialty, but it is in itself very large and encompasses things that I didn't realize it did. So it's been an awakening for me, going from a general commercial litigator and who would sometimes do e-discovery to just a specialist who only does e-discovery. It's been eye-opening to me just how difficult and how much more there is the deeper you go into it.
I can echo that. I mean, I've done about 60 of these podcasts, and I tell people when I go out on the search and retrieval area that, you know, I do the podcast to help me with issue spotting, but it makes me aware that there's a lot out there. It really does. It's impossible to be a specialist across the entire field. It's a good point.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and of course, then my partners or other lawyers I meet don't get it, because they think e-discovery itself is a narrow, small little specialty. And when I say, oh, geez, I wouldn't do that kind of forensic work, I would bring in another specialist on that. They don't quite get it, that a specialty in turn has specialties. There's a huge knowledge gap between folks like us that just do it and attorneys that have either never done it or have just dabbled in it. And this is the great challenge to people that care about the profession and where we're going, is to share this information and, bring up the whole harbor, if you will, raise the whole sea, the whole level of understanding has to be raised for everyone in order for our profession to survive this technological onslaught that, this rapid change that we're all being, subjected to, if you will. We gotta share the knowledge, and we cannot afford as a profession to only have e-discovery specialists know anything about e-discovery. That's just something I feel strongly about, is that it needs to be shared as much as possible.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about the e-discovery process, because you know, it becomes clear you got to have some knowledge right on in the beginning to even make this thing work, because current thinking says having a good meet and confer and cooperating with the other side at the beginning is really critical to reducing e-discovery issues, or at least dealing with them. And how do you ensure this happens without e-discovery expertise on your team? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's like, mandating a rule that people speak French to each other at the beginning of a case. If they don't speak French, it's just not happening. it's barely happening that they're having 26F conferences, but to have a rule that says, and during the conference, you will discuss French literature, you have to bring in a person that speaks French to do that. A specialist, and most clients are unwilling to pay for that. Most lawyers are unwilling to take the time to learn French. They're fine with English, thank you very much. And so as a consequence, the statistics show that even in the federal system, it's about 30% only of the 26F conferences is electronic discovery even mentioned. And even then, it might be mentioned, and they may say, and this comes out of that survey, recent survey out of D.C., I forget the group you may recall that did that. But even then, a lot of times the discussion is, well, you know what, let's not do any e-discovery, at least not at first. Let's try and do the case without it if we can.
Yeah, so, I mean, the understanding of that if you got these issues, you got to cooperate, which is foreign to most litigators. I mean, it's not a traditional tool used by many litigators who are adversarial oftentimes.
Well, I'm more optimistic about the cooperation because I think, I would disagree a little bit with your statement in that if lawyers are confident and comfortable in their knowledge, they can cooperate because they know what is going to potentially endanger their case and be detrimental to their client and what won't. So most lawyers understand that whether the deposition is at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, for instance, doesn't really make any difference, and they will cooperate. What goes around comes around. They will cooperate on simple technical matters. Any lawyer during a trial is not going to object to a leading question at the beginning of asking questions of a witness where you always ask leading questions just to make the witness more comfortable, like, isn't it true you live in Florida, things like that. Technically, you could object, but if you did, you know what? The judge would look at you like you were a complete idiot because it is common protocol and an accepted professionalism to not make such objections, but to cooperate. And why is that? It's to move things along. It's to facilitate the process. And that's in your client's best interest. And lawyers do cooperate on small matters that they understand. So I'm going to the defense of lawyers and cooperation. It is ingrained in every trial lawyer, every litigation lawyer, to have a certain bit of cooperation. On the other hand, it's also ingrained to fight for your client's rights and not to give up on things where you may potentially have an advantage. And the problem lies in that a lot of trial lawyers, perhaps most, are not trained enough in e-discovery to know what is a merely technical matter that it doesn't matter if you stipulate to, and what is a critical thing that you need to fight for. And since they don't know where the line is, and since they're afraid of these ambiguous gray lines, they're afraid of accidentally prejudicing their own client by cooperation. It's not the fear of cooperation, it's the fear of screwing up and prejudicing their client that I think drives it. And so the solution is knowledge. And once they get it, the metadata is nothing to be afraid of, and that you should stipulate to that, and it's not damaging your clients. You're going to get rid of a good third of the sanction cases you have going on right now where people don't cooperate because they don't know enough to stipulate, and they don't know enough to do what really is in their client's best interest, and that is focus on the real disputes, not on these minor little technical matters.
I mean, one of the other areas that makes this area challenging to work in is the role of new technology and new tools. You know, litigators, I think, oftentimes like bright line rules and dislike uncertainty, as do most lawyers, because we're paid to give the right advice, and uncertainty makes it harder. But the landscape in e-discovery always seems to be changing. The one example, we did a recent show on backup tapes, and for a number of years after the Coleman case, the Morgan Stanley case, everyone always thought, oh my God, you have to avoid backup tapes, you know, would draw the line there. But the technology is changing rapidly in this area. Prices have come down, and sometimes it might make the most sense to look to your backup tapes in an old case. And, you know, so it's hard, you know, with technology changes to, you know, the keeping your playbook current is one of the other issues that I see out there.
Well, it is. It's a problem. But, you know, trial lawyers are really good at learning stuff. Because the generalists, anyway, that's what they do. Each case, they learn some new business. They learn some new subject matter. They learn a new area of the law. Most really good trial lawyers are also good at learning. So I'm optimistic that they can learn it if they're inclined to do so and if they're given a chance to learn it, a way to learn it. And that's why I spend so much time writing and stuff, is to give them that chance. Because I'm convinced once they learn it, they'll get beyond the knee-jerk, I don't know, so I'm going to fight over everything, and they will cooperate. And that's, you know, cooperation is, to me, one of the legs on the three-legged chair that e-discovery needs to stand on.
Well, what so then, you know, most lawyers are generalists, okay, and in fact, the vast majority of them are. What role do you see them playing to be effective in electronic discovery?
Well, I see them playing a role, first of all, of getting beyond the fear of saying they don't know. You know, a lot of if a lawyer is willing to admit and say I don't know and ask questions when an IT person speaks a language, starts speaking French at them, and say, wait a minute, I don't know, that's the first step. It's like, you know, the Zen student has to have an empty glass there for the information to come in. So once that happens, and any IT consultant will tell you, that a lot of people just nod and say yes, and they know perfectly well that they don't understand what they're saying. And you know, a good consultant will come in and will spell it out in proper language and won't allow a person just to nod and say yes when they know they don't get it. So a lot of that, it comes from, you know, the trial lawyer's got to take an attitude of, okay, this is something, discovery, that we now have to learn again. Now, I understand where they're coming from. Well, geez, they learned discovery in their first year of practice. They don't, you know, most trial lawyers think of discovery as pretty simple, as, well, that's something you give a young associate to do. You know, how hard are interrogatories? Hey, after the first 100 depositions, they're all pretty easy. You can do a deposition. You know, requests for admissions, they're simple. Requests for productions, oh, yeah, I've done that a million times. Well, what they don't know is that last thing, request for productions, suddenly, and I mean just over the last 10 years or so, has become a nightmare of complexity. And it is not something you can just give to the associates or just gloss over. It's something that you're either going to have to take the time to really learn it, or you're going to have to bring in somebody else that does, a specialist, and learn how to work with that specialist. So another role that general trial counsel might be is somebody who is kind of a client. You know, I work with a lot of trial lawyers that don't really want to know e-discovery. That's fine. All they know is they know how to get me on the phone. They know how to be basically the client. And I am then serving the trial counsel. They're my client. We both serve another client, if you will. But that's the role of the specialist, is working with general trial counsel. It's a brand new role. Never happened before. There was never discovery specialists before in the 30 years I've been practicing law. This is all new stuff to have that. So it's a matter of kind of feeling out what the roles are, how you do that, what are the rules of the game. You know, a lot of times part of my thing is learning, you know, when I step back, because I was a trial lawyer for a long time, but I don't step on turf anymore. I just worry about the e-discovery. And then if it comes up and people ask me, well, I'll give them the benefit of my experience in trial as well. And honestly, that does make you more effective as an e-discovery specialist if you've had a life in general litigation. It really, you can see the big picture that just the IT guys that have never done trial work, they're never really going to be able to give the same kind of practical, common sense, good advice that somebody who's been in the courtroom could give you.
Well, let's talk about the people that the generalists that aren't learning and are ignoring the issue, maybe. There have been many statistics given about the opt-out issue in electronic discovery. We both have seen that 30% number of cases where the meet and confer even deals with e-discovery. And I did a podcast with George Socha where he gave some statistics, and I think he might have cited where that study was in that podcast. But I also anecdotally hear that same concern from judges who are sometimes shocked. I remember talking to a prominent judge here in Western Pennsylvania who basically asked the parties, are you really sure you're not addressing e-discovery at this point? And so, you know, from your perspective, what are the biggest risks you see from not addressing e-discovery up front and effectively running a case?
Well, I mean, that's the worst time to discuss e-discovery is at the end of the case. And that's why the rules are written the way they are. They're written to try and force federal practitioners to address it at the beginning of a case rather than at the end. That's why it's on the list of topics in 26F. That's why, in my opinion, courts ought to start having mandatory 16B hearings, which most federal courts do not, you know, but because it's a lot of work, and I don't blame them. Their dockets are too busy. But you know what? If the judges would do that, would always schedule a 16B hearing to discuss your Rule 26F conference and your report, your case management report, then the judge would specifically ask them, what about e-discovery? Where is that? What have you talked about in that? That's what it's going to take to force lawyers to do what they don't want to do, most lawyers, and that is discuss e-discovery. They don't want to do it because, like I said, they don't know how to speak French, and they haven't had a good course offered to them where they can learn it, and there aren't enough e-discovery specialists out there for them to turn to. There's only really a few of us that do it. And, you know, when that happens, when the judges use the power and hold the lawyers their feet to the fire with a 16B hearing and put the question to them, that's going to force lawyers to go ahead and do it up front like the rules require. You know, the alternative is they will opt out, and that's what they're doing, continue to do, have always done, and are continuing to do it. And you know what? If it's done with informed consent of the clients, there's nothing wrong with that. If it's done with informed consent of the clients, you know, you can decide not to do any discovery at all, right? There's nothing that requires you to do it. Usually one side or the other is going to want to actually do some discovery, though. And if they want to do discovery that includes the writings, then they have entered the world of e-discovery. So, you know, that's my thing, is inform consent with the clients, talk them out, you know, the reason the clients are saying or agreeing with the opt-out if they're being asked, but if they're being asked and they agree, it's because of the dollars. And they're being told, well, if we do e-discovery, it will cost $1 million. And this case is only worth $2 million, so the client says, you can't quote exactly what the client says because there'll be certain profanities in that. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line to the client's reaction is no. Then let's do the best we can without it. You know, the solution to that is we got to make e-discovery affordable, which is, you know, a whole other conversation. But the bottom line to how do you make e-discovery affordable is the same answer to most e-discovery questions, and that is, you educate the practitioners involved. so that they know what they're doing, so that they can do e-discovery in an affordable way, which is e-discovery 2.0, if you will, the second paradigm of e-discovery that I've been working on for years and other people have too, and that is how to do bottom-line-based discovery instead of the original way e-discovery was being done and is frankly is still being done by some experts where you just collect everything and throw it all up on a review platform and review it all and damned with the cost. That's just what it is. So it all comes back to education in my stilted view of the informed consumer, which is also what generalists are. They become a consumer not only of the services of specialists, but also of specialist attorneys, but also of vendors. And, you know, if they're an informed consumer, they are going to end up doing it cheaper than if they're an uninformed consumer with a blank check.
I mean, there are a number of judicial opinions out there. The U.S. versus Michael John O'Keefe, Judge Facciola's opinion, where he talked about the complexity of search and topics beyond the ken of laymen. And then we even got the more recent case in 2009, the In Majid et al. V. BL Development Corp. Firm Mississippi, where the judge, magistrate, Judge Alan Alexander, imposed an electronic discovery expert on defendants. So I guess there is, you know, what we've been saying is there's a strong recognition that you know, sometimes you have to look to experts. Sometimes the judge will tell you to look to experts. How do you think you find experts? You know, I mean, what's your advice for finding these specialists for generalists?
Well, that's a good question. I mean,
there are only two of us on the podcast, so.
Yeah, you know, I don't. It's not easy because it's not like there is a list of people with LLMs in electronic discovery. You know, it's not as if there aren't a lot of incredible claims being made out there by a lot of vendors. I mean, I just had one the other day. It's funny, they cold call lawyers by they just do a website search to find out who is the, you know, if they have an e-discovery department or something on the website, and then they'll get the names, usually one or two chairs, and then they'll cold call them. And I'm not going to name names here, but this person had no idea who I was, just, you know, was on a list, and they start with their spiel. Now, I imagine half the time they get interrupted and they never finish that first spiel, but I'm just one of these curious people to see what are the vendors saying. And this, by the way, was not just some small local vendor. This was a big national vendor. What is their pitch? And my God, it was shocking. The gross exaggerations, the wild claims that are being made, and you know, to me, it's just shocking. We got a Wild West out there. EDRM is working on a code of ethics for vendors, and someday they'll get there. I saw that the latest Sedona webinar coming up on ethics is going to include a discussion about vendors crossing the line and doing the unauthorized practice of law. That's a huge issue of all non-law firm consultants where they have lawyers on staff, but they allegedly don't give legal advice. This is very hard if you're working for a vendor and you're a lawyer not to give legal advice, but this is another problem that we're facing in this kind of Wild West, still early stage of a new legal service that we're entering in. So bottom line, how do you find an expert? Right now it's very difficult. After my 3.5 years of just doing e-discovery, I've kind of figured out who the best are in different areas, who's good and who's not. But could I do it just be going online and looking at all the wild claims? No, probably not. So it's pretty much word of mouth. You know, George Socha said he gives up a ranking the companies. They're not going to do that anymore. which is probably a good thing. So there's not even, you know, maybe Gartner is going to move into the field. They already are starting some ranking, but that's more of software. That's not of actual outside experts. So the short answer to your question is, how do you go about finding the right experts? Kind of word of mouth, reputation, checking people out, just the old-fashioned way, like you would go to find any expert that you were searching for. You know, how would you find a good economist? Things like that. It's a difficult process, and you have to do your homework. And buyer beware.
And then even once you have your expert, you know, one of the podcasts we did on focusing on ESI effectively, which we did with Sherry Harris, she made a point that even within her firm, she'd been called in after a case had begun progressing, after a lawyer made a decision which she wasn't sure she agreed with, and then she came in and fixed it, and fixed it so well because she's a very extremely knowledgeable e-discovery expert. And, you know, basically, you know, the issue was doing a big data dump and trying to get rid of a case. And she decided that we're better off scoping the case out like you would with paper and being very limited in what we dumped in our data, you know, database. And by being more focused, she was able to reduce the cost sharply and, you know, come up with an ROI on how you do e-scoping. So this case had a very happy ending for her, her firm, and her client. But a lot of times, it's very hard, even if you have a specialist accessible, to know when to call them and get them involved. So, you know, how do you work with your, you know, as a litigator, how do you not charge too far ahead, and when do you call your specialist? I mean, there's some challenges there, don't you think?
Well, honestly, that's the one easy answer. You can't bring in a specialist too early. There is no, I got the e-discovery person in there too early. Never happens. The e-discovery person, if you're on the filing of the lawsuit side, has to be brought in prior to the lawsuit. You know, it's just a no-brainer. If you're on the defense side responding, should be one of your first calls. So, I mean, it's clear. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Now, does that always happen? Well, of course not, because people don't know enough yet. It's a learning process. But, I mean, I got a call about a year ago from a potential client, and they wanted us to come in and try and clean up another firm's work. You know, they were 2 months from trial. Well, it was too late. I mean, when we looked at, you know, at that point in time, it's just too late to fix things. They were on the verge of sanctions. You know, mistakes had already been made. You know, they probably would have been better off actually having us come in, because at that point, the existing attorney had no credibility with the court. And, you know, comes a point when you do need to replace the attorney if the judge basically is saying they don't believe you. That would be a good time maybe to get a new lawyer if you're the client. But, you know, to come in later, it becomes so expensive and so difficult. I mean, I'll do it if you pay me enough, but it's going to be a lot. And I'd rather not, because that's just a real uphill battle to come in at the end game.
So then, you know, the decision to charge ahead, you know, after you get your specialists on board, come up with a game plan, it's probably at that point. I mean, the specialists, you can't. There aren't enough of them, so at some point, you know, lawyers got to do what they normally do. I imagine that there has to be some good communication there as well.
Yeah, and that's, we get back to my little analogy I'm using here of speaking French. You know, let's say the specialist speaks French, or we used to call it computerese. You still hear that term much anymore, Carl?
I have to tell you something funny. I was in a meeting in another city a couple days ago and was told by the lawyer that I was their favorite technology expert they had ever met. And I straddle both sides. I mean, but if you come at it too much in French, you lose people. I see exactly where you're going.
Yeah, we used to call it computerese, and I used to, you know, back in the 80s, that would get a big laugh. But anyway, it's true. It's gotten even worse because there's more language. The systems are more complicated. So communication is a critical thing. I mean, getting back to my three-legged stool, the one leg is cooperation, but the other leg is having a functional interdisciplinary e-discovery team. And that's why I call my blog e-discovery team. Oh, by the way, did you notice I now have my blog with the domain name ediscoveryteam.com, so you don't have to remember ralphlosi.wordpress, etc. This is something I did over Christmas. So, you know, that is critical, that to work with lawyers and IT people working together, both speaking this kind of Creole French-English combination, if you will, teaching the English speakers, the regular lawyers, a little bit of tech talk so that they can understand and use the word deduplicate, and then even go on and learn vertical and horizontal deduplicate and know what the heck they're talking about. That's good. These are some basic terminology, basic French that the English lawyer needs to learn. And guys like us mustn't forget our English. We need to put things into everyday language as well. We need to speak the king's English or the judge's English so that we don't come across as people who are incomprehensible and thus worthless. I mean, language is the key to make that team work. And before I forget, too, so lest I be accused of not finishing my thought of the three-legged stool, the third leg is the one thing you've already been mentioning, but I'll put a label on it, and that is using technology and the new methods that are being developed that take advantage of modeling, things like statistics, quality control. The other great paper that Jason was the editor on in Sedona on quality. These are the three things that we need to do e-discovery, and you know, coming out with a blog on that soon. But it's cooperation, working with teams, and then using technology is the third thing.
Well, you know, the one area I want to sort of wrap up on in this area, in this space is, and you touched about on it, was the wild claims that you run into from others about, you know, how maybe the tools they have or, you know, the team they have in place and how easy it is. I have been seeing a lot of buzz and chatter about coming up with standards, you know, certified e-discovery expert. Do you think we're ready for that? Do you think that's a solution?
Well, got to be careful what we're talking about there. Coming up with standards is something a little different. Sedona has been working hard on standards, and I think they're doing a terrific job on it, in the sense of best practices. I work hard on that. A lot of people work hard on that to try and have best practices. That's different, I think, than this thing coming, this other movement coming out of a paralegal organization about certification. Certification without education is, in my view, not the way to go. The key thing, the critical thing, is education. That's why I devote every Wednesday to go up to Gainesville and teach, and so do a lot of other people now are focusing on the academic world, and we're all doing legal tech, we're doing, you know, all kinds of CLE activities. We're probably, eDiscovery has a tremendously committed group of lawyers who are focused on education, and really it's pretty impressive how many people donate and volunteer their time to do that. That's, I think, the right way to go about it, is to have education and bring the quality of education up. Not all CLEs are created equal, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some CLEs are just sales talk. And the lawyers, I think, are catching on to that. And they don't want a sales talk CLE. They want real information. But the kind of the valid thing to this whole certification movement is, well, how do you know? How do you know if this is real talk? How do you know if this guy really knows what he's talking about? And this is a, you know, this is nothing unique to e-discovery. This happens every time there's a new area of law. I mean, I've seen it through the course of my 30 years career. There didn't used to be local bar certification of specialists when I started practicing. There weren't any in Florida. I don't know if there were in New York, Pennsylvania stuff, but, you know, it was just starting out. So in the course of my – now a Florida bar has, I don't know, a dozen or more certifications as a specialist. And if you're not certified in that area, you're not allowed to call yourself a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
I am not allowed to call myself an e-discovery specialist. What I am allowed to say is that I concentrate my time in e-discovery and just do e-discovery. That's the truth. But I cannot make a claim that I'm a specialist. Why? Because there isn't a certifying body of the Florida Bar or any place else that will certify me as a specialist. Now, you can draw your own conclusions by reading the three books, blah, blah, blah. But I am not making any claims in print or advertising as being a specialist. This is how the bar polices and controls this whole situation, Wild West situation, if you may call it, of who's really got the skills and who doesn't. So in that sense, this drive for certification has a lot of common sense behind it. When we have so many people and so many vendors, But we're not going to have vendor certification. The only thing we're really going to have are professional certification, and then the professionals will help you get the right vendors and sort things out. Problem with the bars doing certification is I think we're still a long ways off from that. I watched healthcare, for instance. It took a good 20 years for them to come up with a healthcare certification. I remember one of my partners was doing that, and they created the test, and they finally did it. And the funny thing was he helped write the test, and he didn't pass it the first time he took it. And he's a great healthcare lawyer. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, a testing game, too. Some people are good at testing. So it has to be meaningful certification, and that's either means it's going to be done by the state bar associations, which I think is still a long way off. I mean, we're having trouble getting rules, much less certification. So I think, you know, it's going to have to come someplace else, but it's going to have to come out of meaningful education. And I know I'm starting to sound like a broken record, but certification has to come out of a completion of some kind of educational program, kind of like a diploma. To just create some sort of written test and have people take it is, I don't think, enough to be reliable, no matter who's on the board. I think it has to... You have to show that they put in the time. There's an interesting little discussion going on now with my latest blog. I don't know if you've seen it, where somebody left a comment where in my latest blog I pointed out that a student to do really well is going to be spending in a semester, they may spend as much as 250 hours studying electronic discovery. And if they put in that kind of time, if anybody does, 200, 250 hours, they're going to have a good basic understanding of the field. But then I also went on to quote Malcolm Gladwell in his latest book, Outliers. And by the way, you might want to read that book before New York Legal Tech, because Malcolm is going to be one of the keynote speakers. And
okay.
I'm looking forward to hearing him, because he's one of my favorite authors. And his book, Outliers, is fabulous, and it includes a discussion about an attorney outlier, people that really achieve on the highest levels, which I consider, you know, either, I don't like the fancy word, oh, they're a genius, but I like more, they're a complete master of the subject in the old medieval tradition of being, you know, like Leonardo was a master craftsman. If you're a master craftsman and you're a master of something as complicated as e-discovery, or for that matter, something as complicated as securities transactions, or, you know, hostile takeovers. I mean, who knows what, you name it. There's thousands of millions of very complicated fields. To attain that level of mastery, according to Malcolm Gladwell, studies have shown that it takes about 10,000 hours. The Beatles got to be the top super good, better than everybody else, because they went to Berlin and they put in about 10,000 hours instead of partying in Liverpool. And that's how, when they came back from Germany, they were like, oh my God, this group is so great. That's how they did it. That's one of the many studies that Malcolm Gladwell offers. You want to be a master of e-discovery, you got to pay your dues and spend the time. There's no shortcut. There's no, I'm so smart, I can do it. So you know, to certify without also training is not the way to go. We need to offer training opportunities and education opportunities, and then you just need to get out there and do it. That's what my 3.5 years has taught me, is by doing it and doing it and doing it, I just learned so much. You got to read and study, but then you also got to just get your hands dirty, work on these matters, on a variety of different matters, and you can learn by doing, which, honestly, that's the way lawyers also learn. They don't call it legal practice for nothing.
Well, this has been obviously an issue that's not going to go away quickly. It's going to take some time to sort this out. But I appreciate your insights to this. Do you have any final predictions on how the specialization issue is going to play out in the coming year or decade?
Yeah, I think the technology lawyer, information technology lawyer, electronic records lawyer, is here to stay. We may stop calling ourselves e-discovery specialists or lawyers because it's like when a word gets used too much, it starts losing its meaning. But this function of certain lawyers that try and stay with the curve of technology is here to stay, because technology is not going to stagnate anytime soon. We have lived in a world of constant change, and that will continue throughout the rest of my life, I'm sure, and throughout the life of my children and probably my grandchildren. We're going to be in an age of constant change, constant innovation, constant technological revolution, one after another. Information is going to keep getting more and more complicated, and this is going to be more and more difficult for lawyers to keep up. So the kind of lawyers that love this sort of stuff, that like technology, that like learning, that like keeping up, that is going to be a role that will constantly change. The name we give it may vary and differ, but that particular role is going to, not only is it here to stay, it's going to get bigger and bigger and more important.
Well, thank you, Ralph, for joining us on another show. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. As in the race of ESI Bites co-hosts, you've pulled ahead of Judge Grimm and Facciolo by doing your third show with us. But I got to warn you, Ron Hedges is doing his third show with us on Friday, so you're not going to be in first place for long. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically by the phrase Easy Bites. Incidentally, that's also how I'd like our show to be perceived, not just an easy bite, but more importantly, easily digestible. And however you choose to remember us, just remember to come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.
Goodbye.